Welcome back to Listening to the Dead, Season 2. More crimes, more forensics, more revelations. This is Episode 6, Cause Unknown.
Hello everyone and welcome to the final episode of Season 2. And for this final outing, we're looking at those occasions when cause of death cannot easily be established at the scene, as well as instances where the investigation did not lead to a clear conviction. Let's begin first with a case where the cause of death is not immediately apparent. Kaz, can you give us an idea of how often this happened in your career?
Well, quite often you'd go to a scene and you weren't too sure, but you know, you always kind of like thought murder till it proved otherwise. But the main ones I'd say where it would sort of happen is if you've had a body that's been buried or been left out in woodland and is badly decomposed, at that initial stage, you've got no idea at all how it may have happened. The other cases where you get bad decomposition is, of course, where a body's been in water, be it in a tank of some sort or a river, a canal. If they've been there for a long while, that can cause decompositions and initially cause problems about trying to discover how the person died. But it's the post-mortem that really is going to hopefully take you there, but that isn't always necessarily the case.
Well, that's an excellent link to our first interview. I was lucky enough to chat with Robert Jeffries, formerly of the Thames River Police, and he gave us some insight into the challenges of investigating a body found in the river. Hi, Rob. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Hi, John.
So you were in the River Police for just shy of 20 years, I think. What is the jurisdiction and role of the River Police?
The River Police or the Metropolitan Police Marine Policing Unit, as it these days likes to be called, does everything that a normal police officer would do on land, but on a marine basis. So they police the River Thames. They also police all the other marine environments within London. So all the small rivers, canals, lakes, anything which has a marine problem comes under their remit.
Okay. And so in terms of talking about cause of death, how often are bodies found in the Thames?
It was during my time and still is today, about one a week. We average about 50 a year from the River Thames alone.
Wow, that seems like quite a lot.
Historically, it's a lot fewer than it used to be. Now the Thames, I think, is a lot cleaner. When we get people out, they tend to survive a lot more. In days gone by, early part of the 20th century, the river was much more polluted. And so if you went anywhere near the water, you needed your stomach pumped afterwards. These days when we get them out, we get them to hospital as quickly as we can. In my time, and I think probably the same is true today for the River Police and the Lifeboat Service, that about two-thirds of the ones we pull out alive of the jumpers or that people go into the water.
What are the challenges you find where you're confronted by a body that's been in the water? What are the evidential challenges?
Well, the main thing for us revolves around identification. Some people go to great lengths to disguise their identity. Of course, you can get someone out who's very fresh. You've then got to go through their belongings and determine clues as to what their identity may be. Just because someone's got a wallet with correspondence in the name of John Smith in it doesn't mean that the person you've got from the water is John Smith. There could be any number of reasons why they've got a property in the name of John Smith. So we must go through all the standard forms of identification, starting normally with fingerprints, going on to dental checks. And if some way down the line we can't identify that way, then we move on towards DNA.
Ah, well, I mean, I think about having been in the bath too long and your fingertips go all pruny. Now, surely that's just a challenge of identification in the water.
Well, normally we're dealing with people who are in water in the Thames and in all outdoor environments will be very cold. So the wrinkling of the fingers is only the first stage. While you've got blood flowing through your veins, then that's really all that will happen. When the blood stops flowing, your heart stops beating, that's when decomposition starts. Depending on the temperature, the ambient temperature, the air temperature, the water temperature will depend on the rate of decomposition. The longer the spell in the water, the harder it is to get on ordinary identifications, particularly on fingerprints. Probably if you're in the water longer than about a fortnight, particularly in the summer, you'll probably be on the cusp of whether you'll be able to get checkable fingerprints.
God, that's so interesting. So sort of from what you've said, can the state of preservation be evidence in itself? So, you know, perhaps the decomposition isn't what you expect it to be.
Almost certainly, yes. When you go eventually before a coroner, the coroner will ask you where you've had to identify the body. I mean, some of the bodies are easily identifiable, but when there's been some doubt, the coroner will ask you as part of the identification process to say, is the decomposition of the body contingent with what you'd expect to see in someone who went in the water on that time and place? Now, if he asks that to a pathologist, the pathologist won't give an answer, because a pathologist is a scientist and deals in science and certainties, whereas a police officer who has been for years on the river police will know the sort of decomposition that he would expect to find in a body that's been in a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, or a few months.
I see. So what if we're talking about the Thames here, I mean, it could be any river, I suppose. What are the main causes of death of people who go in? I mean, what's killing you in the Thames?
Well, the first thing you've got to worry about is the temperature of the water. At any time of the year, the River Thames is going to be cold. It's at its warmest, probably in about September, after the sun has been on it for hopefully the summer. And it's probably at its coldest around March, until spring warmth starts to come through. If you enter the River Thames, you will immediately experience cold shock. Now, if you enter from the side of the river, just walk in, then that is a gradual occurrence. The cold will affect your body quickly, but it will take a little while. If you jump off the bridge from a height, the shock of hitting the water will immediately shut down the systems in your body. Your throat will close. So in fact, there's two ways you can drown: a wet drowning and a dry drowning. If you go in walking in out into the water, the chances are you're going to have a wet drowning. The water is going to fill your lungs, and that is what will kill you. If you jump off a bridge and you experience that cold shock, then your throat muscles immediately clench. No water goes down the throat. And what you are in fact doing is suffocating. When your body goes in front of the pathologist for the autopsy, they will be able to see if there's water in the lungs, and that will give them a clue. And that's the sort of thing that will be revealed at the eventual coroner's hearing, the inquest.
Ah, I see. So, do we know how dangerous the Thames is? I mean, like, is it more dangerous than rivers in other cities? Is it because it's faster flowing or wider?
I think the truth of the matter is that any body of water is dangerous. You can drown in a dish full of water. It may sound stupid, but that's the truth of the matter. If it stops air getting into your mouth, that can kill you. The complications of the River Thames are the coldness, the tidal effect, the currents that run in between the bridges, the eddies, etc., and of course river traffic. Moving and stationary, all of these can have an effect on cause of death.
What about when you're investigating and discovering where the body went in? It feels like bodies might drift quite a long way in a river. I mean, the Thames is so tidal, there's a lot of movement of water. Do you find it's difficult to establish?
There's a bit of an old wives' tale going around. They say, oh, if you work in the river, you must know where to... If they go in at so-and-so, then you must know where they're going to come out. I have to say that's, in my experience anyway, nonsense. I've known two people go off a bridge, Westminster Bridge, actually, pretty much hand in hand, a sort of lovers pact, and they turn up in completely different places at different times. One ended up a few days later, substantially downriver. The other one turned up some time later, within about 50 metres of where he went in. So it's a very macro environment. If you go in 1 yard one way, 1 yard the other, you can be affected by other circumstances working in the river. It's possible, for example, to go in on a fairly strong ebbing tide, so you would think the body would be taken downriver, but in fact it gets sucked in under the bridge arches and the abutments to the bridge. There really is no definite science as to saying, they went in there, therefore they're going to come up elsewhere. There are what they call river sets, the sets of the tide, and that might give you an indication of where somebody who might turn up if there's no other circumstances involved. That's why when you're involved in a search and rescue operation on the river, the authorities have what they call a golden hour. The Marine Coast Guard Agency have what they call a golden hour. In that hour, immediately after a call, is when an intense search will be carried out by the police, by the lifeboat, by anyone else in the area. Often the fire brigade are was involved, and they will do a sweep of the river. And if the victim is not recovered in that hour, then it's most unlikely that they're on the surface, and the search will be halted because there's no chance of them being alive.
I think I remember you saying that you were peripherally involved with one of the most infamous cases on the Thames, which was the boy in the river case. What were the circumstances there?
Yes, this was a most unusual case where the body was a body of a very young black boy found in the river, but it was only the torso of the body. So just the torso, no head, no arms or legs. The only bit of clothing was a very bright, garishly yellow set of shorts around the bottom half of the body. It was obviously not an accidental death. There was obviously foul play involved. And so it immediately went to a murder squad, and in fact became one of the best known murders around the time, involving a Pan-African appeal for information by Nelson Mandela. And first of all, it was thought that this might be a South African link, but in fact the investigation team worked out that it must be a Nigerian link, and the boy was in fact eventually identified. And I think actually the murderer was identified as well, but he was already under life imprisonment in Nigeria, so not an awful lot could be done about it.
Rob, this is so fascinating. I mean, I'm sure there's so much more you could tell us. Is there anywhere that the listeners or I could find out a bit more about the Thames River Police?
Well, I do actually run a small museum at Wapping within the old carpenter's workshop, which records the history, the quite fascinating history of the Thames River Police, which goes back to 1798. And if anyone wants to, they can contact me via our website. Just Google Thames Police Museum.
Well, an extraordinary career and so many stories. Thank you for sharing some of them with us today, Rob. And I hope you come back to talk to us again in another series.
That'd be fine. Thank you very much.
So, Linda, all this talk about bodies in water is rather timely, as your most recent novel, just out, in fact, called Judas Horse. In it, you open with a body found in water. Have you had a plot where you decided just in your head, right, I want nobody to know how this body died for at least half the book, and then the reveal? So the pathologist is going to be mystified, the police are going to be mystified. That kind of case where the cause of death, you've kept it back from the reader deliberately.
In Judas Horse, the drowning, it's pretty obvious that the body has been in water for some considerable time. But we're always dependent in crime novel writing and TV, whatever, films, is that you find the body and then you have to get the facts of how it died from the autopsy. The cause of death, I mean, one can invariably use that, and sometimes with very rare poisons, which we did in one of our podcasts. But you are dependent upon the post-mortem report. you can see if it's had bullets or a throat cut. And I think that it's very hard to maintain that mystery. So what one would have to do, if you have a body that you don't know how it died, or you'd have no name, nothing, it's how you get to a point of discovering who it was, and then you're almost working backwards instead of moving forwards, that you're looking for a, you know, .22 bullet, a Kyber, it's a homemade bullet, shot close range, blood splattering. You don't have that.
Mm. Kaz, did you ever work on a case with the Thames River Police?
Yes. Some years back, we had a body on the south bank of the Thames area down by Rotherhithe. There was a head, hands, thigh and calf found, but the head had been totally skinned to stop us. Obviously, we suspected who stop us being able to recognise who the person was, although we had the hands, we were able to get fingerprints, but nothing from it.
Can always rely on you to provide us with a grisly story.
What we wondered was that if could those body parts have floated up the river and kind of got there. I mean, we knew that probably wasn't the case, but if we were to arrest somebody and get to trial, it could be significant. So the river police were able to advise us on the currents, the tides, when they would go up and down, everything. So what we did with their assistance and suggestion was we got a pig and we had the pig cut into pieces that were the same sort of size and weight as our body parts, and used high-strength fishing line to sort of not hold them exactly in position, but with enough line to let it move if they did move. And we left them for 48 hours. And when we went back to look, those parts were in virtually exactly the same place as the body parts were. So from that, we were able to say, well, no, they had to have been thrown in here the night before by somebody just standing on the side and throwing them in. It was about 2 years later that an address was found where it was supposed to have happened. And of course, other people were living in it. Everything had been cleaned. But when we looked behind a radiator, whoever had cleaned must have used a mop. And as they're mopping the floor, it flicked the victim's blood up behind the radiator. And so all those, you know, years later, when we took the radiator off, there was the evidence we needed, but everything else had been cleaned away.
Well, that's a nice segue, Kaz, to our second interview, which is with Angela Gallup, one of the UK's leading forensic scientists, who's investigated some of the most famous cold cases in UK criminal history. Angela, you've had such an illustrious career and worked on numerous landmark cases, including those of Stephen Lawrence, Rachel Nickell, Damiola Taylor, cases we can all remember, I'm sure. But you weren't involved in the initial investigation, I think. You investigated them as cold cases. How did you come to specialise in this area?
Well, we did start in the firm that I co-founded, Forensic Alliance. It was back in the late 90s. But we did start by specialising in cold cases. And it was a sort of, a happy accident when I look back on it now. We had set up this company because before that I'd been doing quite a lot of defence work, supporting lawyers, representing people accused of crimes where there's forensic evidence against them. And because I've been doing that work, I began to see that standards for police were slipping a bit for all sorts of reasons that we understand and all the rest of it. But I couldn't help thinking that there might be a better way of doing stuff for the police. You know, there always is, you know, different firms, you know, go about things in slightly different ways. And the same is true for forensic sciences, for anything else. And so I think with a little bit of concern about what people like Kaz and the other people in the Met and the other forces around the country, the service they were getting, I think that persuaded us that actually maybe it was time to do something for them. It's all very well helping the defence, but it's a question of keeping the balance of forensic science in the criminal justice system. So we set up this guy and a couple of colleagues set up this company, Forensic Alliance, specifically for the police. And one or two forces, particularly provincial forces, took us up on this. And it was absolutely brilliant because it gave us an opportunity to show just how good and imaginative and different we could be. So I was quite grateful for this. But also, they are the most fascinating cases because they have extra challenges to what a current case would have. Mainly the cold cases I've done have been for the police, and so the police will get in touch and, you know, maybe when they're reviewing a case after a few years have elapsed and they think there might be some new technology or new something that might help in the forensic line. But also sometimes for the families of victims or the lawyers representing them, sometimes I or my colleagues have been approached by them, and so we've started reinvestigating something because of that. Those are the two main routes, I think.
Angela, you spoke there about the extra challenges of cold case investigation. Can you give some examples of what the extra challenges might be?
Yes, well, I mean, the very first thing is, well, first of all, understanding it all. So, you know, you've got to be briefed and everything properly by the police because, you know, they will have happened years beforehand, usually. So it's really getting your mind into it. It's not like they've been in the papers recently or anything like that. So you have to get in the right place with it, get the information. Then the next thing is to find what, you know, what exhibits there might be left from them. And that can be really difficult. And there are several cases that we've done where we've been back and back again. Kaz is nodding because you obviously understand this, Kaz, you're going back and back to the FSS archive and they're saying, no, you've had it all. We haven't got anything else. And we are saying, yes, you must have it because it's in the case notes. You've got it. Somebody took a sample and you must have it. And then eventually, you know, next time that you'd go, then they'd say, oh, yes, well, we found that, but now we really haven't got anything. And so several trips like that. So it's not easy. And some of the very idiosyncratic police stalls that exist around the country, or anyway, have in years past, I suspect they're still there today, but that's quite tricky too. And for some reason, police stores, they all seem to have floods. I don't know what it is about whether they choose the stores in particular places, but there's always been a flooding issue whenever you have a police store. But anyway, so you have to gather all these items together. And then you have to see, I mean, some of the items might have been returned if, for example, a force has thought that they'd solved the case, there's been a conviction, they might have returned some of the items. And so there's the trickiness around that. And if items have been in and out, if there have been several investigations over the years, then there could be a potential question of contamination of one item by another. You've got to be really careful about. And certainly before you start trying to present any evidence, you've got to be absolutely certain that contamination couldn't have played a part in it. And you have to have a look at what the scientists have done originally. And so you're sort of identifying holes in things. You know where they come from. You know why they're there. Maybe somebody took a sample from there and tested it. And then, of course, you've got the whole business of the person who got the items first will probably have had the best bits in relation to evidence. So you've got to be more imaginative about where you look for evidence. Maybe look for things that they didn't bother with, or look in different places, or, you know, whatever it might be. So there are all these kinds of challenges that you have, and probably several more. But those sorts of things make it much more difficult.
Absolutely fascinating. It sounds like the preservation of evidence is just so important to any cold case investigation. I just wanted to go back to you there, Kaz. And I was wondering how, in along your career, you saw the preservation of evidence change at the scene, and how you preserve evidence, and whether that has moved on.
Definitely. Excuse me, big time. Yeah, I mean, the first murder scene I ever went to was as a probationer, and it was on Christmas Day, and I was just told to stand by the body. And it wasn't till a few hours later that the CSI, which was known as a lab sergeant, turned up. Nobody wearing any protective clothing, smoking cigarettes. But then as the years progressed, things became, you know, much, much tighter because of contamination issues and because of cases that had been lost through contamination issues, or that being raised or used by the defence, that then it was blue suits, face coverings. You know, everybody nowadays, it's as watertight as it can be to avoid contamination. But that's not to say a drop of sweat isn't going to fall off your head and land on the victim's clothing. But as long as you tell the scientist and you say where it was and that, then you're covering yourself. Packaging-wise, I mean, God, everything just used to be originally just thrown into plastic bags, you know, whether they be a Sainsbury's one or whatever. But then as time moved on, proper exhibits, bags, but the packaging itself is very, very critical. Quite often officers are just taught how to package, say, for example, shoes in a brown paper bag. But if you've got a victim who's been dumped outside and may have been dressed inside or has been dragged, the importance of if you found a suspect's fingerprints on the shoes of your victim, that's powerful evidence. If you put them in a bag and those shoes move about, you could destroy that evidence. So, you know, it's thinking about what have I got and how can I best preserve it so the scientists can get the best evidence out of it for me.
Linda, Angela there spoke about the crucial importance of evidence preservation for these cold case investigations. Your career, I mean, almost uniquely, gives an incredible perspective on the changes in how the police investigate and handle evidence. Because, you know, you started writing contemporary thrillers, and we've got Jane Tennyson as Helen Mirren then. And then now, you know, you've written contemporary thrillers since, and then in the future now, you're writing in the noughties, and you're looking back at the 70s with the young Jane Tennyson series. And so you've got this incredible perspective you can give us. How did you go about researching the 70s? Did you find police officers and forensic investigators from that period who could tell you about it?
Yes, I mean, I couldn't have done the research without Cass. He found the people that were at Hackney Police Station at the time that I was writing, who were absolutely incredible. They couldn't wait to tell you the stories. You know, they couldn't wait. And you know, when we start the series of the young Jane Tennyson, and why I'm dependent on my police informants to me that say, no, we can't have this. And what I'd done was I'd put that they'd use platelets down at a murder investigation where there was a bloodbath, basically. And, you know, my police advisors said, no, we didn't have platelets in those days. So I said, well, what did you use? He said, well, if there was a lot of blood on the carpet that was being trodden in and, you know, losing evidence and possibly a footprint, we used actually some paper or cardboard, anything we could find. So you see that in the 70s, and even in the 80s, they still didn't have those duck boards that they put down. Now the difference is extraordinary. You know, you have a body, and one of the first things the police want to do is protect it. Step aside, don't go near it. The forensic are the main instigators in bringing forth evidence. And to be able to go back in time to a cold case that happened in the 60s and to come up with DNA evidence. And so those, the collection of garments that people or the police always kept after investigating a murder are now proving for a cold case, you know, they are like a piece of magic happens. The science of policing is remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, from what Angela was saying, in some ways there seem to be advantages to cold case investigations, sort of space, time away from the investigation, being able to step back from the instant need to deliver at the scene. Maybe you've got pressure at the scene, maybe there's some press or something like that, and maybe stepping back allows a different perspective on the case. Is that fair, do you think?
To an extent, yes. But as Angela mentioned, one of the biggest problems is the exhibits and where are they? It was a natural process that if you had very heavily bloodstained clothing, yes, that would go to the lab. But when it came back to us, it was taken to an incinerator and destroyed because of the health and safety issues around it. So, of course, things that have gone and they've got lost. Over the years, not so much now, because they'll be retained for a lot longer and they'll be be in safer conditions. But I mean, generally, other things with looking at cold cases sometimes were, I think, missed opportunities. Even back in the day, you know, where a little bit of lateral thinking might have helped. Cases where scientists weren't given all the information. because the detective doesn't really understand what the scientist wants. So he gets new information and he doesn't pass it on. Things like that were important as well. So it is re-looking at things, but I do believe that sometimes things wouldn't have gone wrong first time round had they been dealt with properly. And of course, yeah, police error does come into it.
Yeah. Angela, I mean, we were talking there about different approaches, being able to think laterally. You mentioned it earlier. Can you give some examples of the kind of things you'd be doing?
Well, I think we learned a lot of lessons, you know, over the years. Each case we did, each cold case we did, we learned, you know, something new, something else, or a variation of something. And I think that was tremendously helpful. I think people think that cold case investigation works because you've got new technology. And certainly that's extremely important. But it is not the whole deal. It's only really half of it. I think the things that we learned, I mean, there are loads of them, loads of lessons. But things like you've got to start, you know, got to go back to the crime scene, however old it is, you've got to go back there. And physically back there, so you can kind of get a sense of the geography and the topography of everything and what's possible, what's not possible, what may be likely, what's unlikely. And I think there's a tendency to think, and particularly with the older cases, there's a tendency to think that the people who were at the scenes understood the fine detail of them. And while they generally understood them, often they didn't drill down as much as is actually possible. And I think that's really important because at the scene, as Kaz knows only too well, that's where all your forensic opportunities present themselves because that's where the crime happened. That's where you've got a sequence of events. And so it's understanding that sequence of events, knowing about the dynamic interaction between, say, suspect and victim and all of that, that will tell you where it's a good idea to look for what. And so it's really, really important to understand the scene in detail. And just don't assume that you've got everything first time round because you may not have. And of course, as we've said, you've got more time and space to think about that. And I think there are lots of other lessons. Is don't assume just because you had a really good scientist who did the work originally that they will have necessarily found everything. They may not have. They will have been under pressure. It's a really good point that Kaz makes about scientists or the first time round, they're at the start of the investigation before some of the information's come in through the investigative channels. And maybe some of the investigators don't pass it on to the scientists or not all of it. They're busy doing other things. And so maybe we don't get to hear everything in a live case that you would do with an older one. So that's really important. And I think, too, be careful about historic expectations of things. I'm thinking here of the Stephen Lawrence case where the original scientists and I would have been on the same page with them at that time, but thought that actually it was probably only worth looking for transferred fibre fragments from clothing from the suspects onto Stephen because he didn't go anywhere after he'd been stabbed and when he eventually fell over, whereas the suspects ran off and ran back to their homes, probably, washed their clothes, did anything they liked or wore them or whatever. But all that would increase the likelihood that they lost anything that had been transferred from Stephen at the time of the attack. Whereas, with the other way around, from them to Stephen, you wouldn't have got that. So the main emphasis was on fibre transfer in that direction. Well, we know now, and it's blindingly obvious when you think about it, like a lot of these things. But actually, if they put where they got back home, took the clothing off, put it away in a drawer, then actually it would all stay there beautifully, pristine, still there. It's only if they did something like continue to wear it that you might lose it. So we've learned a lot about that. We've learned that one type of evidence leads to another. Sometimes if you want something, and the Lawrence case is a really good example of this, we were really interested in DNA because it's got such fantastic statistics. But sometimes you can't just look for DNA and find it. You have to look for something else first. You have to look for something which tells you what to focus on. And so in the Lawrence case, we started looking for textile fibres, which are incredibly important because they tell you about what clothing might have been in contact with, what other clothing, and even sometimes what parts of the clothing were in contact. So it's really helpful to point you in the direction and to give you a focus for a really much more detailed blood search. And that was extremely successful in Stephen Lawrence case and also in the Coastal Path Murders. That's what opened that up, this whole fibres thing. And then I think there's something about recognising when you're onto something. I think it's very easy as a scientist to do a really good kind of test, you know, really the sort of thing that you'd want to know the answer to. So you do the test and then actually not really bother to look at the results. I mean, have a quick look, absolutely. And if it's blindingly obvious, of course, you'll see it. But not drill down and say, well, is that a bit of something or is that not? Oh, I think it might be a bit of something. Well, let's just have a look around that. Let's have a dig into that hole. And that also is incredibly important and sometimes gives you the way into a case. So doing that and then realising, and Rachel Nicole case is a really good example of this, realising when things don't stack up. It's another example, I suppose, of not looking deeply enough or thinking deeply enough. But there were some really interesting samples taken from Rachel's body, which were these tapings that we're all so keen on, which are these adhesive tape strips. And we had some of these from exposed parts of Rachel's body, and they were exposed because it was a sexually motivated attack. And obviously the original scientists, they were spot on. They were looking for any DNA that could have come from a male. And so they did the test, absolutely, and they got the results and there wasn't anything there and they thought no more of it. But what they didn't think was, we haven't got any DNA at all. This is really weird because this has been taken from her skin. We should have got a massive reaction from Rachel herself, but they didn't get anything. So that should have told them that there's something wrong with their technique. And so when we realised all that and used our technique, which actually was adjusted from the way they used it, then we got masses of Rachel, but we got a tiny trace of male DNA, which is just what they'd been looking for. And then by developing that using other techniques and creating a whole new technique, actually, a much more sensitive technique, we managed eventually to show that it was, it looked as though it had come from Robert Napper, who was a convicted serial rapist and murderer. And so that was really important there. So looking for dogs that don't bark is what we usually call it. Looking at that, I think when things don't stack up. And then I think realising that sometimes, you know, trusting the science, realising that that some, you know, truth is often stranger than fiction and you may get a really weird result. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means you've got to think about it a bit more, in a bit more detail. And we certainly have had some very interesting results, and to the extent that I remember in one particular case, we had been doing really well and finding evidence that, you know, pointed in a certain direction and so on. And then we came up with this really weird result and the lawyers were saying to us, this is absolutely preposterous. You know, you had a perfectly good case. Now you've gone and wrecked it. Go away and do it again, you know, because you must have got it wrong. So stuff like that. So we've learned an enormous amount about how you do it. I have to say, to finish the story, we did it again several times and got friends in to help who were very good with statistics and that sort of thing. And the evidence just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And so then we had to go back to the crime scene and work out why we would get a result like this. And, of course, it gave us the answer. The crime scene usually does, gave us the answer and made the whole evidence much stronger than it was before, bizarrely. But so you just have to be aware that things like that happen. So new techniques and new approaches go hand in hand.
Cass, I'm really interested now. Did you ever have anyone investigate one of your cases? And if so, how did it make you feel?
Yeah, I have one. It was a case where the guy actually got off in court. We had some really powerful evidence. We had his fingerprint and blood in the victim's car and everything. But he came up with a cock and bull story, really, during trial, which even our barrister said, I am worried the jury are going to believe this. And he was acquitted. And in that case, some years later, they looked at that one again to see if there was anything else, and particularly with the advancements in DNA, if there was anything we could do. Because he had, there was a pair of Selfridge's gardening gloves found as well. But unfortunately, when they went looking for the property, it wasn't there. So so there wasn't anything that that could be done. It had gone. So yeah, in that respect, you kind of get to as you go on in service, you know, you win some, you lose some, you move on.
Yeah, I think that's sort of really important, Angela. I mean, you think about it, like cold cases investigations have the potential to bring a killer to justice or even correct a miscarriage of justice. That's a huge sort of responsibility on you and your team, but it must be enormously rewarding when it goes right, which it has several times in your career.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I suppose it's kind of doubly rewarding where you find evidence that the court believes is enough to, you know, to make the difference in a case. And at the same time, you manage to exonerate someone else, because obviously if the first person did it, the second person couldn't have. So that is doubly satisfying. And there have been quite a few examples of that. There was the Rachel Nickell case, obviously, where Colin Stagg was exonerated, and Lynette White, where the Cardiff Three were exonerated, where it was this chap, Jeffrey Gafford, who was, you know, nobody had ever heard of. I think he wasn't on anybody's radar. So that was quite a good one. And then I suppose even with Damilola Taylor, there were four young people who were taken to court originally, a couple of years after after Damilola died. And I think it was an unreliable child witness Bromley, I think it wasn't it, Kaz, in Damilola Taylor, who kind of scuppered the whole thing because I think everybody was nervous about how reliable her evidence was, or scuppered the prosecution, I should say, but fortunately for the four youngsters on trial. And so I suppose people probably thought after that, oh, well, I bet they were guilty. It's just that they couldn't, you know, they couldn't prove it. But then along come the Preddy brothers. And I always felt rather sorry for the Met police for that, because the Preddy brothers were actually picked up and their clothing seized from them only 5 days after Damilola died, or he was attacked. And yet the Met, over the years that followed, got terribly bad press about, you know, you haven't learnt anything from Stephen Lawrence, you're still not investigating cases with young black boys properly, and all the rest of it. And actually, they had done exactly the right thing. They had identified some really good suspects. They got their clothing. And then when several years later we came along, and one of the first things we did was just to look back over the original suspects. And pretty quickly we found blood on both of the Preddy brothers. One stain was fairly obvious. The other stain was much more difficult to find. But and that had come from Damilola. So, yes, it's doubly satisfying, as I say. But I think you don't, it's a funny thing. It's like every case, you know, you don't get much satisfaction at the time. You may think, yeah, that feels a pretty solid case and we've managed to get it over properly. But it's only when you find the evidence, it's not long before you're thinking, right, now we've got to check contamination, we've got to check this, we've got to check that, we've got to check the other, we can't present it till we're absolutely certain. And so you're off on another journey with it. So it's not like you luxuriate ever about what you've done. You're always on to the next thing. And I think it's quite funny now, looking back over the whole, because I'm at the stage of my career that I am, that it's now, only now really looking back, do I think, well, that was interesting. You know, at the time, I didn't have the time, if you see what I mean. I was worrying about something else, you know.
Interestingly there, Angela, when you mentioned about the evidence, you know, proving or disproving a case, and Colin Stagg, for example, and the police's methods of investigation, having been a detective first on murder squads, then going into the CSI role, I actually realised that detectives very much think, and it's not deliberate, it's kind of the nature of the beast. He did it, I know he did it, so I'm going to find everything to prove he did it. And they concentrate on things that they think will prove their case, whereas scientific principles look at all sides of what could have happened to come to a very objective, balanced answer. And I've always felt that if detectives were to apply that kind of scientific approach into their investigations, they would have better and less subjective investigations. I just wondered if you feel that is the case.
It's quite difficult. I've never worked within the police, so I just think that they are there in the white heat of the investigation, and I think they're under a lot of pressure. And they certainly, I'm sure there's an element of what you say that could come into it. I mean, we've developed it into a kind of art form, I think, now what we do. I think it's really good. I mean, when I first started as a forensic scientist, we used to get submissions that said pretty much what you've said. We know he's done it, just find the evidence, you know. So we used to get that. And we always used to ignore it, obviously. You know, we absolutely had to. But nowadays, we're much more structured about it. Nowadays, we say, well, you know, you've got the prosecution proposition is this, the defence proposition is the other. And the, and even if we have, we don't know what the defence said, we always assume he's going to deny having anything to do with it. So we have these two propositions. What tests can we apply that will help us, the results of which will help us decide whether there's more, something to support the prosecution or the defence? So we have this structure all the time, you know, that we work through. So we do the tests according to, you know, whether they will help us with, you know, who's going to be right. And that's a really helpful thing. And then at the end of the day, we present our evidence rather like that. We've got evidence. And actually, if you think of the prosecution proposition, it's this, the defence one, it's that. And actually, our evidence sits more comfortably on this side than it does on that side. So it's all quite balanced, which I think is really good. But it's interesting you say what you say, Kaz, because that is at the heart of something which worries me about the way forensics is going at the moment. And I have no criticism for the police. I think they're trying to do the best they can with what they've got or the resources they've got. But I think the more forensics they do themselves, the more I worry about it, because I can't see how you can be an organisation that is charged with preventing and then detecting, hunting down criminals when crimes have happened, and at the same time come along and have this fancy balanced view of what the evidence can be. So I worry about that. I'm very keen on supporting them, absolutely, from a scientific point of view, but slightly independent, because I think that's much healthier. But it's just something that I'm very aware of and very concerned about. And you can skew forensic evidence really easily just by the choice of things that you look at and the tests you apply, really easily. And now there's less dialogue between investigator and scientist than there used to be. I mean, we used to have a good old chat about stuff, but now there's, you know, it's much more of a process line of testing. You don't have that opportunity. And I think that's a loss, a real loss. And I do worry about forensic science once again, like in the bad old days, the 1970s, getting really bad press for, you know, contributing to miscarriages, but because of this time.
When that all happened, when they started, you know, setting up their own police labs and that again, that was one of my fears, that actually what you're creating a prosecution orientated business, you know. You need to have to look at all sides of the story. And I agree entirely with that.
Angela, you mentioned some of your landmark cases. Can you remember any of the breakthrough moments, like, you know, the eureka moment in those cases?
Yeah, I probably can. Yes. I mean, I remember with Lynette White, who was the young woman who was killed in Cardiff, a really brutal murder for which the Cardiff Three were wrongly imprisoned. And I remember there we were looking for foreign blood at the scene. She had 50 stab cuts and a cut wrists and cut throats. So there was an awful lot of her blood about. But the original scientist who'd done the case had discovered through blood grouping, which was the only thing available at the time, it was a 1988 murder. They had discovered some blood that was different from Lynette's. And it's quite likely in those circumstances that the blood's come from the offender, because it's such a violent attack. And if you're wielding a sharp instrument like a knife in those circumstances, obviously, blood's very slippery, and so the hand of the offender could slide down very easily off the handle onto the cutting edge of the blade and then get little nicks in the fleshy part of the palm. And then from there on, every thrust made with the knife can scatter their own blood about the crime scene and mixed in with the victim's blood. So there the art is to be able to distinguish which is more likely to be victim blood, and well, most of it will be, which could be offender blood. And so because we knew that there was some foreign blood there, we were very keen on trying to find some more. The problem with Lynette White was that some of the items weren't really suitable for DNA profiling in those days. And there was very little left of this foreign blood because this case described the whole history of DNA profiling. Every new technique came in, they'd use a little bit more of this precious blood to see if they could get a profile out of it, and they weren't getting one. And so in the end, we were in pretty desperate circumstances trying to be as imaginative as possible about where to look for some more of this blood. And so we started looking at stuff that the original scientists hadn't bothered with. And there was a bit of a cellophane from the end of a cigarette packet. And most of the blood on it, we thought, it was a small item, as you can imagine, but most of the blood was smeared. And we thought, well, that's probably from Lynette. But there was one round spot, which indicates it's airborne blood. So it's flown as a droplet through the air and just happened to land on this thing. And that could be the offender blood. So we thought, well, we'll have a go at just that one stain, see if we can get anything out of it. And we got a nearly full profile of foreign blood. It wasn't Lynette's. And so we immediately, imaginatively called him Cellophane Man, because it was a male profile. And that was a breakthrough moment when we thought, now this could be it. Now we've got to find some more. And so we did some amazing things, like we took some woodwork, took the skirting board and the front door off, because we could see in the crime scene photographs, we could see there was some blood that could have been offender blood on these things near the body. And, you know, the front door had smeared blood as whoever was making his way out of the flat obviously was groping in the darkness. It would have been dark then, groping for the handle of the door. So you can see this great smear, and we thought, well, there might be some in there as well. So we got the woodwork off and we scraped away at the paint, because it had this flat had been painted twice in the intervening years, and we were trying to expose any blood that might have been there, hoping desperately that whoever had painted it hadn't bothered to prepare his or her surfaces first. And fortunately, we were lucky, but not scraping too deep when we would wreck the whole blood thing, not scraping too shallow where we'd never expose it. And so it was quite tricky, that whole thing had to be done under the microscope, but we were able to expose some of his blood and then to get a DNA profile out of that, and that matched Cellophane Man. And then we found some cardboard boxes and there was the odd swab and the odd other item from the flat, and we started to get a picture of foreign blood around the body and on the exit route, because we got mixed Lynette and this foreign blood on the front door after scraping the paints. So that was really good. So then we went to Lynette's clothing, and even though it was completely soaked with her own blood, we managed to find, by reenacting the way in which she would have been manhandled because her clothing was misplaced, we managed to get some on the actual body. So in the end, we had it sort of, you know, we had this foreign blood absolutely part of the murder. So that was a particularly satisfying thing. But I think finding the blood on the back of the jacket in Stephen Lawrence, just a tiny spot inside the back of the neck there, which is quite a likely place for, you know, for stabbing. We managed to find that on the jacket of one of the suspects through the fibre route, as I've been explaining earlier. And with the Coastal Path murder, again, we weren't getting anywhere just looking for DNA profiling. The police only wanted us to do DNA profiling in that case. There were a couple of people who were shot at close range on the Coastal Path and then dragged off into the undergrowth nearby at the cliff edge. But when we weren't getting anywhere with DNA. So we said eventually, after 18 months, the SIO rung up and said, I'm absolutely fed up with you and your team, Angela. You aren't getting anywhere. I'm going to take the case off you and give it to someone else who knows what they're doing, I think. And that was a bit difficult. So I said, I'm coming down to see you. Don't do anything. I'm coming down to see you. So I went to see him and I said, you know, really, there might be some blood that we could get DNA from there or on the suspect. But let us first of all have a look at textile fibres, because we think that will help. We think that might open it up. And to do him justice, he was really, really good. And he said, oh, all right, you know, have a bit of time spent on that and then we'll see. And almost immediately we started finding textile links. It was really amazing. And in the end, through our search for textile fibres, which requires rather, you know, a lot of use of microscopy and that sort of thing, we finally found a very small amount of blood on the shorts belonging to the suspect, John Cooper. Then profiled it, and it turned out to match one of the victims, one of the Coastal Path victims, and then we were off. Then we had a load of textile fibres all over the place, and we also connected in another double murder through fibres and a multiple sex attack at gunpoint through fibres. So we had enormous amount, and that we've even found some more of the Coastal Path victims' blood on the gun that this chap used that had been connected with him previously. And so we had an enormous amount of evidence from that. But that I think the eureka moment there was finding that tiny spot of blood on their shorts was amazing. So they all have, Rachel Nickell was obviously the male DNA on the taping. So they all have that moment when you think, I think we're getting somewhere. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. And time and again there in your stories, fibres comes up. I mean, a sort of undervalued form of evidence.
Yeah, definitely.
That's so right. And the problem is now that we are losing all our fibre expertise. We have very few groups now who can do fibres because the police think it's too expensive. And you can understand that. But my God, it can cut through a swathe of investigation.
What price justice, Angela?
Once, when I was working in the forensic lab, I watched a scientist for most of the time I was in the laboratory, and he was very, very carefully removing one very long strand of hair that had been caught round the button in a jacket. And he teased it and teased it out. And there was a eureka moment because it had the bulb at the end for forensic DNA. And I used that in one of the plots. And I also found that because the detail in the forensic work was, to me, so fascinating, I thought, well, I can't really put a scene was somebody teasing out a hair for half an hour. So what I did was I began to do the split screens. So as the investigation continued, you saw on a split screen the scientist working and working and working until he actually got the hair. And it was long too, a long, blonde, natural blonde with a bulb at the end. And so I'm very aware of the importance of fibres in investigation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these are endless reinvestigations. If you did it properly in the first place, you know, by and large, these days anyway, with techniques we've got now, you should get the answer.
Angela, it's been an absolute education. Thank you so much. We could talk forever. And in fact, you've given us inspiration for perhaps a new series of Listening to the Dead on cold cases, because there's so much to say. And we'll certainly have you back for that. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of our guests on this season. It has been a parade of the great and the good of UK forensics, and it's been so fascinating to speak to them all and learn about all the different causes of death. Thank you, Kaz, for your input again. And Linda, it's been such a pleasure. I hope we can read all about these different causes of death in your upcoming novels.
I think so. I really know so much more, and I've learnt so much more from listening to the dead that I most definitely will be coming up with some new.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you again soon for season 3 of Listening to the Dead.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Judas Horse, is out on April the 1st, 2021. In hardback, ebook, and audiobook.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books UK.
CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event. Get inside the mind of serial killers and psychopaths. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there, as will Cass, so come and join us. Quote Bonnier, that is B-O-N-N-I-E-R, to claim a 10% discount. Limited tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. See you there!